From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in September of 2004 when Time magazine profiled President George W. Bush. Now, by that point, the war in Iraq had gone off course from the prior predictions, but the president would not concede it was a mistake. John Dickerson's profile for Time magazine was titled Inside the Mind of George W. Bush, and Dickerson wrote, quote, "For this president, the essence of wisdom lies in knowing when not to change." Dickerson was writing about changing his mind, Bush's commitment to his decisions, no matter the outcome and no matter the evidence. Now, George W. Bush is not the first American leader to proudly extol his own steadfastness to his decisions, but in modern history, Bush stands out for his effort not only to justify every decision, but to paint changing one's mind as a kind of weakness of character. It has seemed to rub off on the presidents that followed, and maybe the media is at fault. When people admit a slight error can be perceived as damning, and the media seems to make hay of that. But here we are in 2017, and we have bubbled off in safe ideological enclaves. Most people don't spend much time with others who hold serious opposing views. Echo chambers feel safe. And then when we do try to debate others, we're frustrated that, boy, people never seem to change their minds. Well, this hour, my guest is a man who focuses on how we form beliefs and what it might take to change them. I can't guarantee that you will learn how to sway your uncle at the next Thanksgiving dinner, but you're going to learn about the nature of belief a little bit more this hour, and that will be good for all of us. My guest is Richard Feldman, professor of philosophy at the University of Rochester, among other things. And Rich, welcome back to the program. Great to have you.
Thanks. Good to be here, Evan.
Well, we're not going to sit here and say to any audience member who's listening that we're going to get political here. We're not going to tell liberals they're always right or conservatives they're always right or the side's always right or wrong. This is about the nature of belief and how we form belief and then how we perceive others when they don't hold the same beliefs. And so let's start there. Do you sense a shift in the way that I kind of described here, that I don't know if it's the media's fault, I don't know if it comes from politics, but I sense that it seems to be kind of a weakness if we admit we change our mind?
I think that's right. In a talk I just gave on campus last night, I talked about that point exactly, that in the political realm, it's often called flip-flopping, and changing your mind, having a different view is seen as a weakness. That seems to me to be a mistake to characterize it that way. Of course there's a problem if somebody says one thing to one audience and a different thing to another audience just in order to make everybody, to please whoever they happen to be speaking with at the time. But the essence of the view I have is that at any particular time, your beliefs ought to be guided by whatever evidence you have. And if you learn something new and that indicates that what you previously thought is not well supported, then the reasonable thing is to change your mind. The refusal to change your mind is, in a way, a refusal to learn anything. So yeah, I think that's a detrimental attitude, and it does seem to me to be a pretty prevalent one.
Does the media make too much hay? Do we call it flip-flopping, or do we sort of splash headlines, president or senator admits error as if it's some sort of a character flaw?
So I think sometimes that happens. I can't say for sure that it's more common now than it was some years ago, but it certainly happens. And I'd be very careful about calling it an error. If the right way to form your beliefs is to follow what evidence you have, what information you have to go on, and it might be that based on earlier information, believing one thing was the reasonable thing to do, and it might be after getting new evidence, a different thing is the reasonable thing to believe, and you haven't made a mistake, you've just learned.
Listeners, I'd love to hear from you this hour because I want to explore maybe your frustrations about public discourse and debate, and we can talk about techniques to identify our own way of forming beliefs and biases and how we can think about others. I guess if you want to ask Rich how to change people's mind, he can help you with that. But it's 844-295-TALK, toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You've got an upcoming lecture. In fact, you mentioned a lecture last night, but you've got the third in a series of three coming up on this Monday. And these are held at Rush Reese Library at the University of Rochester. They are free and open to the public. So mark your calendar for this Monday, the 18th, 7 p.m. Can reasonable people disagree? Well, obviously, you're going to say yes, I think.
Yes.
Or is it not that simple?
It's not that simple.
Oh, this is interesting now.
So of course, people who are generally reasonable, people who are well-meaning, people who are trying to understand issues can come to different conclusions. The title of this talk and some of the things I've thought about over the years is a little bit more refined, a little bit more specific, and the title's maybe a little provocative. But the idea is this. If after a full discussion, after a full examination of all the information we have, I understand why you think what you did and you understand why I think what I did, there's nothing else to look in, there's no other relevant information not examined, then it's a little harder to understand how reasonable people can disagree. It seems as if very often in that case, either one person or the other is misunderstanding, misinterpreting the evidence and drawing the wrong conclusion. Or another theme that we could talk about a little along the way is maybe we're in a position at which we don't have any good basis for choosing one side or the other, and the right thing to do is have no opinion. To suspend judgment until you learn more. So it's in that special case that I wonder about reasonable people disagreeing. That is, can you, with all the same information, reasonably come to different conclusions? And that's a harder one.
But that also means that there are times where we have to do a much better job of saying, I don't know,
yes,
or embracing our lack of expertise.
I think that's entirely right. There was a brief essay written by a group of faculty members from Harvard, Princeton, and Yale that they sent out to their students a week or two ago, beginning of this academic semester, and it was all about think for yourself, and it was encouraging students to examine arguments and not always just stick with whatever the dominant attitude is on campus, not engage in groupthink. And that struck me as entirely right, and I'm completely supportive of that piece of what they wrote. I thought they also should have said, don't be a contrarian either. Don't just think opposite of what the group thinks. You actually have to look at the information. But the other thing that I noticed about this was they wrote about coming to your conclusion, whether you're for or against, pro or not, on everything. And a reaction I had to that was, well, sometimes the right thing to do is to say, I just don't know. I don't have good enough information to come down one side or the other. And very often, I think that's where we are.
Well, one of my favorite sources of ideas and information on how we form beliefs is a podcast called You Are Not So Smart. I love that title.
I don't know that one.
And it's very good. And they not too long ago, the host had social psychologist Matthew Feinberg and sociologist Rob Willer on the program. They had conducted a study that showed conservative participants images of the consequences of climate change. Now, some participants saw images that tapped into conservative moral values of preserving the sacred, for example. Images showed once pure water contaminated or a once pure forest now covered in garbage, things like that. Other participants saw images that tapped into what we might call liberal moral values of protection from harm. Images included a coral reef system being harmed by increased global warming, cracked ground from drought. And conservative participants who saw images that were more sort of embedded with what we would call conservative values reported greater support of climate change policies. So what Willer and Feinberg were saying is essentially this. Not to overly generalize, but let's overly generalize. Conservatives tend to have values that we would describe as, you know, celebrating the individual, patriotism, self-sufficiency, strength. Those are the kinds of terms you often hear if you ask conservatives, what are your values? If you ask liberals or progressives, they often say things like egalitarianism, mm-hmm. equal opportunity, justice, those kinds of things. None of those words are wrong or bad, but they are much more likely to be signaling of progressive or conservative. And what Willer and Feinberg are saying is when we argue with each other, even if we know, if I'm a conservative and you're a progressive and I know you're a progressive, I still use language or arguments or efforts to get you to see why the conservative values I hold are right, instead of saying, hey, from your perspective as a progressive with these core values, mm-hmm. I still think there's evidence that works in this way. And another example of that was they asked liberals to write an op-ed aiming to convince conservatives of the value of same-sex marriage. Only 8% of liberals wrote it any kind of an argument that would appeal to conservatives' value of loyalty to your own kind, equal, you know, individualism. And instead, they were writing about it from liberal points of view. To me, that says we are not doing a good job of humanizing the people we disagree with because they must hold my values or their values are not valid.
So that's an interesting point. The research, I didn't know about that research, but it's interesting. It fits with other kinds of research that I am aware of. And I guess I'll say two things I'll note about that. One is, to the extent that in reasoning with people about things, you're able to bring out the considerations that are affecting them, I think we can make some progress. So if the conservatives and the liberals in the kind of discussion you're talking about can understand that it's these different values that are playing a role in them coming to the conclusions they do, well, maybe there's at least some chance that they can understand that there's other values that might have some merit as well and can lead to a different conclusion. And maybe they can see, if not agreement, they can at least see why the people on the other side are not evil or stupid or somehow just to be dismissed. There's one other thing I do want to say that I think is a very important aspect of how we reason with one another, how we argue with one another, and what we see the point of discussion with others is. This is a thing I did get into last night. You can see argument and discussion as persuasion. And your goal in interacting with somebody is to convince them of your point of view. And there's a book that I find interesting. It's written by an attorney who was somewhat prominent years ago, Jerry Spence, and he wrote a book called How to Argue and Win Every Time. He was an enormously successful attorney. I think he won every case he argued before a jury or something like that. So he really he could win in the sense of persuasion. But there's a very different way you can think about argument, and it's as part of a sort of shared search for the truth. You can see that when you make an argument for your conclusion, I can ask myself the question, oh, what should I think now in light of that argument? What is there in that argument that might actually support your view? Should I change my mind in light of what you said, or should I modify my position in any way? And if you think about the role of others as what you can learn from them, as opposed to how you can beat them, how you can outdo them, I think what it does is it encourages you to interpret what they say in its best possible light. What's the smartest, most compelling thing out of what you said, rather than how can I find some zinger to put you down? And so I think that different attitude toward argument can really be constructive. Now, I'm saying that's a good way for people to be. I'm not asserting that in fact people always are that way, but certainly they're not. But I'd like to encourage it.
Let me grab our first phone call. This is Chris in Brockport. Go ahead, Chris.
Hey, Evan. First, I wanted to say that I'm really enjoying this conversation that you guys are having. I'm a moderate Republican who finds myself often on both sides of the fence, either defending liberal ideas or conservative ideas to liberals. I think one of the big issues that we have today is the fact that everybody is so entrenched in their views, and they basically make these individuals cartoonish villains if they disagree. Like, I've often heard that if you're a Republican, Republicans support Trump, Trump supports white nationalists, and therefore if you're a Republican, you're a racist. I think it's a big problem that everybody basically just kind of says, you're wearing team red colors, that means that all of your arguments are invalid, and they just completely stop listening.
Yeah, Chris, I mean, I'll ask you if you've experienced this, but the one thing that immediately comes to mind is, you know, I've got a lot of small-C conservatives in my family, and they support tax cuts on almost every level, almost every time. And what do some progressives say to them? Well, you support tax cuts because you want the rich to have all the money. Well, I've had long conversations with my family members who are small C conservatives. They truly believe that the best way to create equal opportunity is to reduce taxation because it is their hope. Now, again, we could talk about where the evidence is, and this is where Rich will come in and say, once we get a big enough body of evidence, when do we have to start maybe modifying beliefs? But they believe that by cutting taxes, it allows job creators, however you want to define that, to create more opportunity, particularly for people who are struggling, for people who maybe are in poverty, and that they do view that as the way to more equal opportunity, not just to concentrate wealth. And they feel caricatured by progressives who think you are greedy, you want to keep all the money, and they truly don't believe that. I can tell you that from conversations, at least in my own family. But they just don't feel like we get anywhere because of the way they're caricatured. And as a moderate Republican yourself, have you experienced that?
Well, I strive whenever I have a conversation with an individual to immediately try to agree with something that they believe in. So if I'm talking to a strong Trump supporter or a strong conservative, I go ahead and say, listen, I'm conservative, I completely agree, but I disagree with you on these points. Same thing with liberals. If I'm talking to a liberal, the first thing I go out with is, I'm a never Trumper, I never voted for him, but I have these fundamental beliefs in the size of the government. I'm a little different than your relatives in that I'm okay with any sort of taxes that my local municipality or even state government want to throw at me. I believe that should be bottom up, not top down, in terms of the federal government should try to stay as far out as possible. But as far as New York State, we all live in the nanny state of the country. It's either us or California that are competing for that. And I choose to live here. So I choose to live here, and therefore I'm know what I'm going to get. I'm going to get more government in my life, and I'm okay with that, if that makes sense. But as far as, like, it takes a lot. And the frustrating thing is the fact that I have to go out of my way. I've not met many people who go ahead and just completely try to shed the viewpoint of, okay, these guys are on the other team. So I'll see two other people arguing, and they'll just be completely talking past each other.
If I could...
And not really listening to why they feel that. Like, a fundamental issue is every single person has their own experiences. And that's one of the things I really take to heart when I'm talking to Trump voters. They have a reason why they voted for Trump. And there's a completely logical reason why they voted. Do I agree with that conclusion? No. But they do have a reason. And just saying that all Trump supporters are racist, kind of like how Ta-Nehisi Coates did it, it completely turns off the argument and therefore makes any argument that Ta-Nehisi Coates is saying against Trump invalid in those Trump voters' eyes.
All right, so let me ask Richard Feldman to respond here and stay on the line, Chris. You got a lot to work with there.
So, Chris, I do have to admire your approach, and I completely support that, and I think it's probably unfortunately too rare. So I think you're right on a number of things. One is that there's a tendency to sort of pigeonhole people, and if you think one thing, you must think a whole set of other things that are often associated with it, and people are more complicated than that. And I think one other thing there is the idea that I think what you expressed fits quite well with the idea I have, which is when somebody says something that you don't agree with, what you can try to do is understand why they think it, and maybe you'll learn something. Now, maybe you won't, but you can try, as opposed to just dismissing it. There's a episode of This American Life that I'd like to mention that's just such an interesting example of some of what we're talking about. It aired in late July, and it told the story of a man in Alaska, in Baker, Alaska, a remote town about as far off the beaten path as you can get and still be in this country. And a referendum was brought in front of the town council there in support of immigrants. It's just to be welcoming to immigrants. It wasn't a policy. It was just a statement of welcome. And it caused a great deal of debate and anger in the community. And the reporter for This American Life met up with one guy who didn't have a view about it and wanted to understand and was frustrated by the kind of hostility and just the thoughtless, angry arguments from one side or other, just the kind of thing you talked about. But what was fascinating about the story is that this person, Ben was his name, did a great deal of research, and he spent time reading and trying to understand on the internet. He read reports from think tanks and the like, and eventually he came to the conclusion that immigrants, welcoming of immigrants, an increase of immigrant population led to an increase of crime. And he came down against the resolution, and he didn't feel good about it. And the reporter said, well, if I could get you in touch with somebody who knows more about the topic, would you listen? And they did. And the last part of the episode was a three-way conversation. This American Life reporter, the Ben from Alaska, and somebody from the BBC who is, I think, in Germany and dealt with immigration issues. And they went through all the sources that Ben had looked at. And some of them were confirmed and some of them were undermined. And by the end of the discussion, Ben had changed his mind and came to think he'd made a mistake. And it's a powerful example of somebody trying to be reasonable, to follow the evidence, to do the right thing. But it was really hard. And he only came out where he did because he happened to get connected to this guy from This American Life who got him connected to somebody in Germany who was able to help him out. So it's a really powerful story, but interesting story, and I commend it, but it also shows how difficult it is to work our way through these issues.
Yeah, and Chris, I want to follow up on one more point with you, and then I'll let you go, and I appreciate this phone call. You know, you used a phrase to describe New York State. You said we're one of the two nanny states in the country. And progressives, I think, sometimes feel caricatured. And I'm not saying you are, but let me kind of set something up here and you can respond. You know, progressives tend to feel caricatured when conservatives say, well, you know, liberals just want to basically enslave people. They just want massive government. They want government running your life. You know, if you talk to the progressives in my family, the people around me, they see, I'll give you an example. They look at the 2008 financial collapse as evidence that if we don't have strong regulation, unfortunately, people in power are going to do really destructive things, really hurtful things, and that they wish we didn't have to occasionally use government as a mechanism to enforce what we think are public goods, but we don't have a choice. We have to do it that way, otherwise we're in trouble. And therefore, government is a tool for good when used by people, you know, who are not corrupt, and that it's not evil, it's not about enslaving, it's not about creating a nanny state. And so I always think whenever I have a conversation with anybody who disagrees with me, I want to be able to summarize their argument in a way that they would agree. I always try to say, am I summarizing your view correctly? And if they say yes, then at least I can understand their view and then work with it, as opposed to, hey, you know, you're a liberal, so if I understand you, you just want to enslave people, correct? You know, no one is going to say yes, and it shuts down, but we don't usually summarize the arguments. I'm not saying you were, Chris, but I know that liberals will hear that and they'll say, well, there's another conservative who doesn't get it. You know what I mean?
So you picked up on a terminology I typically throw around. As I was saying with adjusting my talking point. So, like, if I'm talking to a conservative, I'll say that because they all say that, and it's something, it's a throwaway term that is something that I can use to relate to the individual. That being said, I am a part-time listener, Evan, and I know that you're a progressive-leaning individual, which I can respect. What I meant simply by that is, The way I feel government, just like how you guys do use the financial crisis as an example of when powerful people go unchecked, government helps rein that in. I think that is true. And I'm actually kind of weird in a sense of that because I'm not sure the best way to handle multinational organizations or corporations. So it may be best for that to be handled by the federal government. But the concern I feel is not that individuals in government bad. It's there's the risk of an all-encompassing force that could basically, quote unquote, do a 1984. That's basically my driving piece on this. The reason why I believe in smaller government, just I think I'm going on a tangent, but is because the closer you are to the people, in terms of like local elections, et cetera, like Mayor Lovely Warren, you have more voice. While with the federal government, with the presidential elections, electoral college, I actually briefly spoke with you on this on election day. I'm a conservative in New York. I know where my vote's going to go with the president. So
right.
By bringing more power locally, you have more control, and I think you'll get more participation in terms of that. But again, with multinational corporations, it's kind of like anybody's ballgame. That might be best done at a federal level.
Yeah, I don't think that's a tangent at all. I mean, I think there's a lot of intellectual honesty there. And if I'm understanding your argument correctly, it's that even progressives who have good intentions with allowing government to grow bigger might miss the concern you have, which is a slippery slope to, you know, the unintended consequences of a too powerful state that we have seen manifest
exactly.
In other places. And I don't think that that's an unrealistic or intellectually dishonest concern to have. And so I think that, you and the people that you have dialogue with probably do each other a lot of good in at least respecting, the intentions are good, the values may be different, and the framework may be different, but at least having that understanding is important. Otherwise, you're right, we're just talking past each other.
Perhaps one other thing to add to that is that if you're able to identify the concerns on each side, then you might get to the point where you discuss what really is, in most of these cases, the key issue, which is a weighing of various factors. And so in this case, you might weigh the risks associated with the kind of slippery slope that you just expressed a concern with the value that might come from providing the benefits that are in question. And I won't take a stand on where that weighs out, but at least you can identify the factors and then try to weigh them, as opposed to just identifying the point on your side and then there's the point on the other side and you just sort of hit each other with that.
Yeah. Chris, thank you. Great phone call. And thanks for listening, by the way.
Thank you. And I just want to leave this with this. The fundamental issue is I'm not having that argument. I'm having arguments Trump is bad, and that's it. And it's very frustrating, this political climate that we're in.
Yeah, I understand that frustration. I understand why people who hold certain values feel like Trump is bad and they're going to just lay that down as a marker and not want to engage more. And I'm not here to lecture anybody. That's Rich Feldman's job. You're the lecturer here. But I do think that if we understand the argument that people can make, and that's the baseline for me. Can you properly summarize the ideological opposition's argument in a way that they would agree with? If you can at least do that, then you can at least try to start finding ways to either find common ground or maybe chip away at that. But if we are if we're making caricatures, then I don't necessarily think we're going to make any progress. I'm way late for a break. Herman, we'll get your phone call coming up. I've got some emails to read as well. We are talking to Richard Feldman, who is a professor of philosophy at the University of Rochester. He has a lecture coming up, the third in a three-part series, but it's okay if you didn't go to the first two. You can go on Monday night. Monday night at 7 p.m. at Rush Reese Library, free and open to the public. And that lecture, Can Reasonable People Disagree? Interestingly enough, it's not as simple as you think, and really, really interesting stuff and food for thought from him. So let's get that break and come back to more of your comments and phone calls next. Coming up in our second hour, actress Andie MacDowell joins us. You've seen her in movies like Groundhog Day and so many others. She's been a star for years, but most people don't know her life story, her family story, dealing with her mother's addiction, how it caused her to grow up at a very early age and learn about how addiction can impact family. She's coming to Rochester. We've got a preview with her next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and let's get Herman in Brighton on the phone next. Go ahead, Herman.
Hi, I'd like to give two examples of where I have changed my mind on some big issues, and I'd like to explain my thought process that got me there, because I think there's a dearth of critical thinking in society these days. And then I also have a question. The first one is about the death penalty. When I was a teenager and in my 20s, I was pro-death penalty. But at some point in my life, I had several occasions to serve on a jury, and although these were not capital cases, I certainly was able to observe that the legal system and the way that trials are run are perhaps not as good and as reliable and as likely to achieve justice as I perhaps had imagined. Then I started hearing stories in the news about people who had spent sometimes decades in prison being exonerated, and some of them had been on death row. And so my conclusion was, while there may be, I'm sure there are people that deserve the death penalty, but I would much rather take a chance on hundreds or thousands of people who deserve the death penalty instead spending life in prison, rather than risking even one innocent person being executed. So that's example number one, and okay, that's my thought process. Example number two is also quite early in my life. I remember hearing just in passing on the radio that in the UK, homosexual acts between consenting adults had been decriminalized. And my instant reaction, I had never really thought about that before, my instant reaction was, why would anybody want to do that? Why would they want to decriminalize that? Well, needless to say, I see things completely differently now. And my thought process there is with an analogy. Okay, I'm Jewish, and in my religion, I am required to observe a lot of laws that other people are not required to observe, including, for example, dietary laws and the observance of the Sabbath. But nobody, not I or nobody else in their right mind, would want to impose these religious laws on the rest of society. And, of course, our Constitution forbids the imposition of religious law through legislation. And so by that same logic, you know, and religions certainly have a right to have their own rules and laws for their adherents, but just because homosexuality is forbidden in several religions, that does not mean that anybody has a right to impose that through legislation on the entirety of society. Anyway, so that's my thought process there.
Okay.
And my question is, I sometimes get frustrated. I have gotten, I consider myself moderately liberal, but I have gotten into political arguments both with conservatives and with liberals on different issues. And I get very frustrated when evidence and logical, reasoned arguments are totally powerless against entrenched ideology. And that sounds to me like this is right along the topic that your guest is speaking about, and I would love to get some, you know, some advice as to how to deal with that, whether this be a liberal that is convinced that vaccines, and by the way, it's not just liberals, but libertarians,
you know, sure,
a lot,
yeah,
that vaccines cause autism, or a conservative, you know, you know as well as I do what some of the issues are that they are so convinced of.
Okay.
So anyway, thank you. That's all I have to say.
Yeah, Herman, thank you. And hey, thanks for at least, you know, being willing to identify major beliefs of yours that have changed. I find there's something disarming about that, Rich, when
sure,
I'm in a conversation and I say, look, my mind has changed on a lot of subjects, mm-hmm, and my mind is always open to change. I try to tell people that if we are debating, I always tell them, you can change my mind. I promise you it will change if, you know, the evidence,
sure,
is there for it. But what would you say to her?
So, sure, I too, it's good to hear somebody who is responsive to evidence. I wish I had some short and sweet answer to his question about how to get people to be more responsive to arguments and to be better at critical thinking. This is a thing I've taught some of these kinds of skills in courses at the U of R throughout my career and written about it. But I don't have any magic formula other than trying to help people to understand what their arguments really are and try to get them to see what their, get them to identify their evidence, try to get them to see whether that evidence really does support the conclusion they draw, whether there's other evidence they ought to take into account and try to work with them to be reasonable. I did also want to pick up on one of the points that came up in Herman's discussion of his change in mind about the death penalty, because it highlighted a thing that I think is important and can cause us trouble in our discussions with people, and that's this: in the case of the death penalty, there's not one question. There's lots of questions that are relevant to the issue. So one issue is the sort of big issue is should we as a society ever impose the death penalty? And if the answer to that is yes, for which crimes? But then in thinking about that, there's a host of specific, more specific kinds of questions, like is it in fact a deterrent? As it's actually administered, is it done in a fair way? Are there cases of people who are given the death penalty and were innocent? Are there improper convictions? And so on. And once you understand that the final decision about what to do is a product of the decisions about all the other questions, and many of those other questions are ones that empirical research can give us the best answers we might be able to derive, you can at least see what the question is, as opposed to having your feeling and citing whatever you might want to have in its behavior. Half. And in Herman's case, he did seem to see new evidence and put that into the picture and draw his conclusion.
Yeah.
Good thing.
You know, so for example, when Herman's frustration, his question to you, you know, when you find people who are obstinate and you can't break through dogma, if someone is convinced that the death penalty should be legal, they might say, it's a deterrent. Of course it would be a deterrent, yeah, without studying,
yes,
whether in fact it's a deterrent or not.
Yes.
And we now have research that helps us understand,
yes,
whether it's a deterrent or not. And Herman might say, how can I even, in their own mind, it has to be a deterrent. How do I get them to say, oh, wait, there's research? Is my opinion or conviction on this correct or incorrect? How do we get people to do that?
So, you know, again, I wish I had the formula for that. I think one thing that can be helpful is if you approach them in a more respectful way, understanding what they're saying rather than just opposing. So I mean, Evan, you said you approach discussions with the idea that you can be open-minded if and willing to change. If you can let people know that, maybe that can be helpful in getting them to do it too. But it's hard, and there are people that you just can't do it. I recognize that, but I think it is worth it to just keep trying to be reasonable.
All right, let me grab some emails here that have come in. First, from Robert, he writes to us and says, one of the many problems in the way we speak and debate with each other is that far too often we listen not with the intention of understanding, but with the intent to reply.
Exactly. I mean, I think that's what I was saying earlier on, that try to understand rather than rebut.
Okay. John in Rochester next. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, I very rarely have hard political disagreements with people. In fact, the people that I cherish the most really disagree with me. And I think some of it comes to a classical humility that one should have.
Yeah.
I'm actually expert in a pretty esoteric field, and it's amazed how little I know about my field. And it's not amazed at how much people with no training or experience believe they know. And I think a way to avoid that is something called syntopic reading. Back in the 40s, there was a book written on how to read a book, and syntopic reading means that when you read something, you go back and look at the primary source, you read other books. And that was really hard to do before the internet. So I hear all these complaints that, gee, it's hard to get good news. But the fact is, everything worthwhile, you can call up the laws, you can call up primary research papers. There's no reason to have to Yes, and in fact, I sort of do that with my friends. They'll say something, and then we'll go and pull the text up from a speech, and everybody scratches their head and says, gee, I didn't know that was the case. And there's one thing that NPR, I think, maybe a decent source, but they annoy me sometimes, too, on one of the morning programs they had, for example, how I think you can be misled. They had a program on the decreasing human fertility rate. It's down by 50% in 40 years. And, you know, they left it open. And the problem is, if you actually just go and look at that in the medical library of the National Library of Medicine, which is everybody has access to it online, what you'll find is that this isn't just a human problem. I mean, all species have declining fertility. So what they've done is given a story and left out the real punchlines that we've changed something in the world. It's not what we're eating as humans. It's something that we've really changed in the world. And some of these changes are ascribed to other reasons. So, and I think this idea comes out of school. Kids aren't taught how to read. They're given information. And when you take a test, there's a definitive answer. And the reality of it is that we need to address uncertainty. Mm-hmm. Nobody's certain of anything.
Okay, John, let me let Rich jump in there. Go ahead.
So just one comment on that. I don't disagree, I don't think, with any of that. And I love the kind of humility that you started with. One comment, though, on the last point about the fertility example on NPR. I mean, I think that's an interesting example, but your ability to react to that one, as you did, if I understood you, came from a kind of expertise you have in that discipline or that area. Most listeners would, you know, just take that and have nothing to do, no better thing to do than to take it at face value. And unless they really were interested, would just not even know where to begin looking to research it. They're not in a position. They don't have the time to do it. And so it's a real challenge as consumers of information to know what to do. It's so often the case that when you actually do know something about it, you understand that these stories like that, that there's more to it. But if you don't know that, it's difficult to know what to do about it.
Let me tell you an example of ignoring evidence that happened on this program that has been invoked a lot in conversations I have with listeners. After the general election this past year, I sought in the weeks that followed to put together panels of voters from different backgrounds who supported the president to help people understand. Particularly, there were a lot of progressives who are sort of looking at the election and saying, well, how could that have happened? And there was a bit of a caricature that, well, all Trump voters were, sort of working class, more rural. And that's not the case. There's a lot of especially wealthy white women voted for Donald Trump. And we know that in pretty strong numbers. And so we wanted to talk to, you know, local women who supported Donald Trump, and we put together a panel. Now, they happened to all agree that the most important issue to them was they described themselves as pro-life, and the elevation of Mike Pence to the ticket was very hopeful for them because they'd like to see Roe v. Wade overturned, and they're very concerned about abortion. What I wanted to talk to them about was the idea of consistent life and if they endorse the importance of life beyond just the issue of abortion, and they all said they did. And then I said, well, if that's the case, look at Donald Trump making fun of a reporter's disability, mocking someone's disability. Does that at all sway you when you evaluate whether he's truly values life? And one of the panelists said, well, I heard that the media made that up and it's not true. Mm-hmm. And I said, no, I can show you the video. I'm happy to show you that it's true. And one of the, you know, so it was, and then there was like, well, okay, well, big deal. You know, they came in without the proper information of whether it was true or not, claimed it mattered, and then once corrected on the evidence, kind of just breezed right past. Now, I'm not saying that should have changed an opinion, but there didn't seem to be any consideration. And as you look at evidence, Rich, I think it's important to keep going back to the fact that things are complex. Mm-hmm. Understanding evidence, it's a piece here, it's a piece there. How does it weight together? And that didn't seem to be happening.
I think that sounds like it wasn't happening there. And I think that fits with what seems to happen altogether too often and what I think a lot of the psychological research seems to support, which is what people tend to do is they have their opinion or they have their beliefs, and as information comes in, they figure out a way to deal with that so as to maintain the view they've already had. So rather than modifying your view in light of the kind of example you just gave, or kind of information you just gave, the person dismisses it as not reliable. And it's very easy to do that now because this phrase fake news is so prevalent, and so you can just dismiss anything that doesn't fit as somehow not true and maintain your view. And it's just the opposite of the more, what I'd say, reasonable approach, which is to take in that evidence and try to figure it out. So a person could say, in the case you just gave, yeah, that's not a good thing. I don't support that. But the pro-life, the anti-abortion issue is so important that for me, that outweighs everything. And that's how I make my vote. But I'll cast my vote. But instead, what they do is dismiss the evidence.
Right. And that's where, let me read one more email. I go back to the conversation we had with author Kurt Anderson, who was on the program recently. He wrote the book Fantasyland. And his argument is that the United States is sort of unique in developed countries in our sort of dismissal of evidence. So Dave writes to the program and says, doesn't it depend on one's integrity and need for honest correctness in one's life? I mean, all the facts in the world won't make one person believe anything another person proffers if they are not of a nature to expect that new evidence will make a difference. In America, so many I speak with say the same thing. We are free to think what we wish in America. There is no need to believe anything we don't believe, period. How do you converse someone with that kind of a nature? That's from Dave, but that's the same argument that Kurt Anderson makes in Fantasyland, that we have cultivated this idea that in America, you can believe whatever you want.
So a couple of things on that. I've heard about that book, and it's on my list, but I haven't been able to read it yet. But I'm in no position to argue about whether it's more that kind of attitude is more prevalent here than elsewhere. But this idea that we're free to believe whatever we want, I think we should be careful about that. So sure, legally, we should be free to believe whatever we want. Nobody should be punished for believing what they do. We endorse freedom of speech, and people should be able to say what they wish. And I completely support that. I was on this show last spring to talk about that kind of issue and free speech on campus. So absolutely, that's true. But you're not free to just dismiss the evidence, and there's something not okay about believing something even when the evidence goes against you, and there's something unreasonable about that, and it's not. I think we ought not encourage the idea that it's perfectly okay to believe what you feel like believing, what makes you feel good, and dismiss the evidence that goes against you.
I don't think you're calling for, again, the imposition of any law against it.
No, absolutely not.
But maybe you don't deserve the expectation that there won't be a social cost to essentially dismissing evidence routinely.
Something like that. I don't know what kind of cost. I mean, if the cost is just how public dialogue went,
sure.
if when you did that, if what your friends, colleagues said to you was, well, no, you're mistaken in drawing that conclusion, that would be good.
Some final thoughts now from Richard Feldman. Again, I want you to know that on this coming Monday, 7 p.m. at Rush Reese Library, it's the third of three free public lectures. The first was on what is reasonable belief. The second, argument and public discourse. The third, coming up on Monday night, can reasonable people disagree? And again, without giving away too much here, why don't you let our listeners know what they're going to hear from you on Monday night? Because again, as I did, I thought a lot of people would hear that and say, well, of course reasonable people can disagree.
So what one of the things I will do is talk about what exactly disagreement means. So there's a difference between you like vanilla ice cream and I like chocolate ice cream. So we differ, but that's not really a disagreement. There's a disagreement in my sense when there's some statement and you think it's true and I think it's false. And so we differ about what the facts are. And while I think when people who are in very different circumstances can, and with different information, different evidence, surely they can come to different conclusions and be fully reasonable, I will think about the case that's actually true for many of us in real life dialogues where we do share a lot of the same information and we come to different conclusions. And how can we both be reasonable then? We should be respectful always, I say.
Respectful always, but that's not the same as reasonable.
Yes.
Interesting.
Right.
Richard Feldman from the University of Rochester, thank you for helping us think through these issues. I know it can be frustrating conversations and discourse, but I don't endorse giving up.
Nor do I.
Productive discourse. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Monday night, 7 p.m., Rush Reese Library to continue that conversation. Short break, more connections next.